This has been a highly coordinated effort to misinform the electorate, to frighten patients, and to misinform policymakers even about the most basic math that's underlying this proposal.
If this is not changed appreciably, the only recourse will basically to be to pursue legal action on this as well too. There's too much riding. It's not just a reimbursement cut.
This is Dan Diamond, and you're listening to Pulse Check. Some have called Medicare's plan to change how doctors get paid for drugs the biggest Washington fight that you don't know about. Well, after listening to today's podcast, you will know all about it. And hopefully, you'll like our own pilot project, this special podcast, a little bit more than lobbyists are liking Medicare's planned demonstration. First, you'll hear my interview with Peter Bach, a Memorial Sloan Kettering researcher who is in favor of Medicare's planned pilot. Then I sat down with Ted Okun, who runs the Community Oncology Alliance and is vehemently, vehemently opposed to the demo, even threatening a lawsuit. And then stick around to the end, you will hear my colleagues, Sarah Carlin Smith and Brett Norman, join me to play referee and explain, from their perspective, where the demo fight stands right now. A quick reminder, you can find Pulse Check on iTunes, Stitcher, your favorite podcast app. Just search for Pulse Check, and please leave ratings, reviews, subscribe. Every time we get a new subscription or rating on iTunes, Pulse Check gets a little bit of a bump on the charts. It helps new people find the show too. And with that, let's hear from Peter Bach.
The growth in drug spending has been dramatically high these past number of years.
Fastest growing sector of healthcare for the last 3 years.
How did we get here?
Every other type of spending, I mean, if it's from a comparative basis, every other category or channel of spending we have in healthcare is paid off of fee schedules, which are negotiated or arrived at to some extent influenced by a macro budget. So the way we update hospital payments, the way we update physician payments and things like that is influenced by how much we want to spend or projected to spend or have a target. So everything else has a sort of natural or regulatory or some other kind of constraint on it. Drug spending has largely been left untouched. And so as companies have gotten more and more comfortable of both raising prices of existing products and attaching larger and larger, higher and higher launch prices on new products, they've just gotten more skilled at extracting more dollars out of the system, and they are not constrained in the way that all these other sectors are.
So you're saying that it's a regulatory failure. There are loopholes in the system that allow for drug pricing concessions and drug spending rise that other sectors don't have.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think of it as a loophole. I think of it as the last frontier, right? So, you know, if you look back into the history of American medicine, it used to be that every sector of healthcare was paid simply what it chose to charge, right? Hospitals would just send bills, essentially, and so would doctors, and they would get paid, and then it slowly migrated to sort of usual ambient or usual and customary, and eventually things got out of control enough, and the spending got large enough that people said, wait a second, and hence inpatient prospective payment system, hence the RBRVS system for doctors, hence MDS 2.0 for rehab facilities and nursing homes. You know, ways of paying that were sort of rational and based on the service delivered. And drugs have just been left out, in part because laws and regs, both the state and federal level, protect them, but in part because we just sort of haven't gotten to them. And clearly in the last year, there's an appetite for closing this access gap that has emerged because prices are out of control, because prices are so high that patients can't get medications that would benefit them because of high co-insurance and deductibles.
It does feel like there's more momentum. In the decade or so that I've been tracking healthcare from the journalism side, there's more momentum to do something about drug prices now than I can remember. You're more embedded in this space, so maybe you have a better sense for that. But why is there more momentum now? Is it because of the high profile do-batters, the opposite of the do-gooders maybe, who have extracted as many dollars as possible from this space? Is it because we're in the last year of an administration that wants to accomplish long-lasting healthcare changes, something else?
Well, working backwards, I don't think it's because of the administration coming towards, you know, the waning days of the second term. I mean, there was a major move on healthcare by this administration already, right, in his first term, and, you know, they...
One of the first things they did.
One of the first things they did, but, you know, step one of that process was agreeing with the pharmaceutical industry to leave it essentially untouched. And the sort of donut hole trade-off, you know, can be shown demonstrably to be in the interest of the industry because they're able to raise prices without restraint. So it's very nice to have discounts, but as long as you have control of the list price, you're all good. I think there's a confluence of forces. I think you're right that we've reached a point where, you know, there's real pressure to do something.
You mentioned Medicare, which is at the center of one of the most controversial proposals right now in this space, this idea of a demonstration project to change how Medicare reimburses for physician-administered drugs in the Part B program. This has been, Peter, in the past number of weeks that I've been here at Politico, this has been the number one issue in terms of letters I get from constituent groups, articles submitted to be looked at for Pulse. It has become such a hot-button topic here in D.C. You've been following it along the way. You were one of the folks who came out with a testimonial in favor of this demo project when CMS first announced it. Are you surprised by the amount of pushback over this proposal?
It's been absolutely fascinating.
And it might be helpful to even frame what this proposal is.
Yeah, all right, so the topic is Part B drugs, the drugs that physicians and hospitals administer to patients. The way it works is the doctors and hospitals buy the drugs, then they give them to the patients, and then they send a bill to Medicare. And right now, as it's constructed, the hospitals and the doctors get to send a bill for Medicare, which is more than the cost of buying the drug. It's something called the average sales price plus a percentage. All what Medicare has proposed, it has two parts, let's just focus on the first part. What Medicare has proposed, they're gonna pay a little bit less percentage, and then they're gonna pay a fixed fee every time you give a drug instead. So instead of having it be the case where when you give a drug like Yervoy, which costs $30,000, instead of the doctor making 6%, they'll only make 2% on that, but they'll get a flat fee. But if they give a super cheap drug like Decadron or something like that, instead of getting a de minimis, like pennies added on, they'll get $16 added or $16.80 added on. And so the idea is to reduce to some extent this heavy skew towards prescribing more expensive drugs because of the proportional profits.
Right, because the percentage gives that physician X number of dollars more for a more expensive drug.
Right, and it has to do, let me be casual for a second, it has to do with how you view the doctor's role. Do you view them as a broker, like a real estate broker, where if the real estate broker sells an expensive house, they make more money than a cheap house? Or do you view them more like the UPS delivery guy who, what doesn't matter if what's inside the box is a stuffed bunny or a bunch of diamonds, they get paid the same to bring the box. And neither of those are perfect analogies, but the current system has the doctors making more money and the hospitals if they prescribe expensive drugs. And we have about 10 years of research showing that prescribing shifts with profits. So when the profits suddenly disappear with the drug because of a price change, prescribing goes down. And when they go up because of a price change or reimbursement change, prescribing goes up. And the important thing, I'm gonna get in the weeds here in a second, but the important thing is if you set about to design a way of paying doctors and hospitals for drugs, the one thing you would not do is pay them more for expensive drugs and cheap drugs, because it would make them lean towards expensive drugs. And that's not even the big problem. What you've done is you've created a way for companies to buy market share by raising their prices. Okay, that is the problem with the system. And in this recent report we had, we showed that in fact, not only, which we've been showing for a long time, that companies keep raising prices of new drugs, but they have been raising the prices of old drugs because they can create, I mean, I would love to be in a business whereby I could get more sales by raising my prices. because that's how this system is set up.
You said that it was fascinating to watch this battle unfold these past couple weeks. Why? Why has it been so fascinating for you?
Well, I run this thing that's called the Evidence-Driven Drug Pricing Project. The whole idea of it, and it's based at Sloan Kettering, and the whole idea is to bring data to bear on policy issues. And so what's fascinating to me is I think about questions of policy from an empiric basis. Let's go measure what's happening. Let's understand how that fits with the current policy. And if we perturb the policy, can we use data to predict what will happen? And, you know, many discussions in policy circles are a mix of speculation and data. But this has been a highly coordinated effort to misinform the electorate, to frighten patients, and to misinform policymakers even about the most basic math that's underlying this proposal. And, you know, as somebody who lives in an academic world, like, I find that fascinating because I would...
Fascinating seems like the most generous word you could use to describe that.
Oh, no, it is, because, like, you imagine policy would be... We all agree, and it's Moynihan, I think, who said, you know, everyone gets their own opinion, but not everyone gets their own facts. But, I mean, I think the reason he said it is because apparently everyone gets their own facts, too, right? The, you know, if you look at the op-eds, presumably they've been submitted, the postings, the newspaper ads, even the things told to patients by their doctors, which have led patients to write to Medicare, it's, you know, demonstrably false. Right, so, you know, people refer to it as a pay cut because they only say...
Cancer docs have called it a pay cut specifically.
Cancer doctors have called it a pay cut, and it's sort of suffused, you know, the system, and then they don't just call it a pay cut, they call it a drastic pay cut because they only talk about how the percentage-based profit is reduced, and they act like the flat fee add-on, which makes up for it, doesn't exist. And to me, that's the dichotomy, right, between let's have an honest discussion about how this math works, a little bit less percentage, more flat fee, versus just only the percentage profit. But, you know, that's sort of, you know, and we just posted a report about this. When we had sequestration in 2013, when the government did a mandated cut on everything, they reduced the payments to cancer doctors by 2% for drugs. The doctors at that time said, if you don't reverse that, you know, Armageddon, we're all going to go bankrupt. We're going to start sending our patients to the hospital instead. We can't practice as doctors. So to me, that's a place where data can come to bear. So we looked in Medicare, and we looked if any of those things actually happened, because that actually was a pay cut. And the pilot program, if they adjust the flat fee, which I think they will, won't be a pay cut. When sequester happened, this true pay cut. We actually tracked the patients with cancer and we were able to show that none of these things happened. The doctors weren't sending the patients to the hospital for expensive drugs. They weren't actually sending the patients to hospitals at all. Like one in 200 patients went to the hospitals at all. And when they did, they weren't going there for more expensive drugs than the doctors were giving in their offices. It just didn't happen. And, you know, Armageddon for cancer doctors, we looked at enrollment of the doctors in the Medicare program over 4 years, and they didn't drop out, even though they said they're all going out of business. They dropped out, you know, 7% disappeared, just like every other specialty we looked at. So, you know, there's an example where, you know, here's data. This is what actually happened. So now when we change the payment formula but don't reduce total reimbursement, why would you think those things that they're predicting would occur?
That's one argument against the demo. Another argument that I've heard, in fact, on this podcast, Chip Kahn, head of the Federation of American Hospitals, came on and said, it's the wrong proposal at the wrong time because it's an overreach, because it's affecting too many physicians, and a traditional Medicare demonstration should be something smaller, that this is going to be unveiled to a dramatically larger population than ideal. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I mean, it's again, fascinating, right? It's a classic tactic, right? So a reasonable payment proposal that could actually affect the market has to be at scale, right? And so one way of keeping the market from being altered is to scope it down, right? To reduce it. And I don't remember the exact story, but there was something with like diabetes testing strips or something in Medicare that was supposed to be nationwide and ended up scoped down to maybe one county in Florida or something like that. And then after 5 years, maybe they're going to expand it to two counties in Florida. And so, you know, just sort of pushed to the side without being stopped. There's something very important here. It has to be at scale. Let me explain it. Medicare pays this add-on based on prices from 6 months earlier. It's called lagged reimbursement.
Right.
We've shown that the size of the add-on dictates how fast companies can raise their prices. And MedPAC showed that the size of the add-on when it's reduced through sequester reduces the price discrimination by the intermediaries. So let me explain both of those things. Under the current add-on, companies are able to raise their prices 3 or 4% per year for every one of their drugs because there's headroom with because of this markup. If we reduced it, like Medicare is proposing, down to 1 or 2% or something like that, that would slow price inflation, which would save Medicare money, and more importantly, would save beneficiaries who pay 20 cents on the dollar for these drugs. They would save them money. But it'll only work if it's at a scale where the companies have to hold down the price inflation to maintain market. If you reduce it to one county in Florida, the manufacturers will find a way around it. But the other thing is price discrimination. The way this system works is that doctors earn rebates and payments by growing market share. And so they have to be able to do that and pay some doctors more and others less in order to keep up with that business, these intermediaries. If you shrink that margin in a wide enough scope, they can't do this. They can't pay doctors to use more drug that maybe is not in the best interest of patients. So that's what's going on here. And this is why this has been such a vitriolic response to a payment formula change. It threatens the very business model of pharma, which is to get a drug on the market and then steadily raise its price and pay doctors on the back end to use it.
Though with any payment reform change, any major pilot that Medicare might pursue, there is the challenge of not knowing what will come, even if the best evidence and policy says that only good outcomes are ahead, the fear that once this is implemented in the real world at scale, there will be negative adverse consequences, which is not unique necessarily to a demo. That happens all the time in healthcare. Do you understand why that argument might play here? Not just that Medicare needs to do this for the financials to work, but that once this is rolled out, there could be negative downstream impact for patients in some way that we can't tell right now. And that's why it should be maybe not one county in Florida, but maybe not half the counties in the states.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, two answers. One is, you know, more negative consequences than what we have right now, which is 28% of patients exhausting all of their savings and patients unable to pick up prescriptions at the pharmacy because they can't afford the out-of-pocket or premiums on Part D rising, then, you know, it's sort of like you always have to think about, like, compared to what? And what we have right now is unabated price inflation, the highest prices in the world, and lack of access. But the other thing is, you know, Medicare has now been criticized for designing this in a way to figure out exactly what you just hypothesized. They're going to pay doctors in different regions differently, some on the traditional formula, some on the new formula, to see what happens. And they've been criticized for being thoughtful and, you know, being measured in rolling this out.
How would you like to see drug price reform accomplished? And maybe this pilot is one of those tools, but this can't be the only tool. I've heard you speak on various ideas that aren't included in this Part B pilot. So what should our system do to improve drug price efficiency, improve access? What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, all right, well, let me paint a picture. Right? 3 years from now or something like this, there's an entity that isn't a manufacturer and it's not a payer, and it solves this market failure. And I call it a market failure because we have rising prices on one side and we have collapsing access on the other. And the manufacturers are fond of pointing at the insurers like to point at the manufacturers, they both point at the PBMs, but still.
Pharmacy benefit managers,
yeah. The classic sort of intermediary that negotiates with both sides, right? But the fact that is indisputable is that we have patients with diseases who aren't getting drugs that would be effective for them because they can't. And so what we probably need, and I think it can be voluntary, is we need a sort of pricing coalition or pricing approach that finds appropriate prices for drugs based on their evidence, based on how well they work, based on what population they target, based on our collective goals for, you know, improving health in our society, and finds those right prices and publishes them. And then if manufacturers agree to those prices, then payers have to include the drugs on their formularies and give them access to patients at low coinsurance, like $3 or $5 or something. Because that's when we need to sort of fix this market. Right now, manufacturers want the most they can get, of course. Payers want to pay the least they have to. And there's these intermediaries who are playing both sides against the middle. And like I said, we have market failures as a consequence. And we have all these artificial things, like certain hospitals called 340B get discounts. Medicaid has this rule where they get the cheapest price, whatever it is, so that any other negotiation is always being weighed down by this Medicaid anchor. You know, and we just need a way, and it's not simple, but we need a fully transparent way to take drugs based on their own evidence and find the proper prices. And it's totally within the realm of possible. We have this drug abacus tool, which is a way of thinking about it for cancer drugs. The Institute for Clinical and Economic Review in Boston, or ICER, has started to publish reports trying to find fair prices for drugs. But the important thing is, let's do that in a way that's fully transparent, that takes full advantage of the data, that collectively brings forward our values and rewards companies that make important new drugs with profit, so that that kind of innovation is spurred. And let's make sure that, you know, we're not lagging behind other Western countries in terms of access for the drugs, many of which, as you pointed out, are sold by U.S. companies or invented in the U.S. Because that is the other side of this. We talk about leading the world in biomedical innovation. You know, we're lagging the world in having our sick people get access to these innovations.
Given how much drug pricing and drug access has been a focus on the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton has talked about this, even Donald Trump has talked about the possibility of negotiating around drug prices. Do you see this as something that the next administration could prioritize in the relatively early going?
It does feel that way, and I think it's really hard to prognosticate about either, candidate when they're actually president, or if they become president. But
I have to ask, has either campaign contacted you?
You do have to ask that. That's true. I think it's hard to prognosticate.
I'll take your lack of answer as answer.
Yeah, whatever. It's look, there's many people in the health policy space concerned about these issues, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm always happy to talk to anyone about.
Case in point, you're talking to me.
Well, exactly. It's like, but see, it proves how long the list is, Dan. The failing of access and the crushing cost of rising premiums are two issues that cannot be ignored by either side, any longer. And I said it earlier, like, we are in essence in this problem because of the success of the pharmaceutical innovation cycle. I don't think we would be sweating this issue if we weren't looking across the chasm at drugs that would help people. And as I said before, you know, you go to Germany or France, all of the patients there have access to these same drugs at much lower prices. So it's not just that we're paying more. It's that we're paying more and our people aren't necessarily even getting the product.
Hey, this is Dan Diamond. And if you like when healthcare experts spar over key issues, then I have the event for you. Next Tuesday, June 21st, Politico is hosting a breakfast roundtable on scope of practice issues in healthcare. It's at the Hotel Liaison on Capitol Hill, and you can find details and an RSVP link in the Morning Pulse newsletter, which I hope you're all getting. It's free, and it's like getting Pulse Check just on a daily basis in your email and text form. Anyway, now back to the podcast. We've got Ted Okun, the Executive Director of the Community Oncology Alliance, sitting down with me now. Ted, you're coming from the Hill today, and you told me when we were walking into this room that it was another Part B meeting. Part B all the time. How does this discussion over the Part B demo, Part B experiment, depending on how you talk and think about it, how does this compare to some of the other fights that you've had over the years with COA?
Yeah, I think, Dan, it's really tough when you think about it, because a lot of the fights that we've had before are just kind of pure reimbursement. So if you look at back when the sequester hit and the CMS applied the sequester cut to the underlying cost of drugs, that was pure reimbursement. This is fundamentally very different, because let's take the reimbursement cut aside, put it aside for a minute. This is about CMS doing a couple things. Number one, saying physicians aren't doing the right thing. And so, therefore, they are going to use finances to change clinical decision-making. And that is really fairly radical in the context of then changing reimbursement. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but I actually ran a clinical research network
in oncology. I did not know that, yeah.
So I know clinical research. And when you're doing clinical research and you're going to change clinical decision making, that's what clinical research is about, and comparing test and control. That's exactly the words that CMS is using. They're using test and control. They're going to randomize geography and therefore patients into test and control areas. Three quarters of the country is going to be in a test. The quarter is going to be in a control. And as a result of that, it's clinical research. The problem is that in any ethical clinical research, you are informing the patient, do they want to participate? In this case, it's totally mandatory. In fact, the patients don't even know. They're not given what you would call informed consent in the research process. And they're not monitoring any of the adverse events. This is clinical research. And the ironic thing is, and so a lot of people do know this, I live in this kind of bizarre world of like all this policy, and then I go home at night, or when I'm back in Connecticut, where I really live, people think I live here in D.C., who do I talk to? My wife. What does she do? She's an oncology nurse.
It's all in the family.
It's all in the family. The problem is, Dan, she doesn't want to hear about any of these acronyms, you know, that I come talking about, ASP and 340B and all these acronyms. She says, let me give you a dose of reality. And the dose of reality is her and her patients. That's what she cares about. And it was interesting, because when I described, I said, okay, no policy, but let me explain a situation to you. And I explained this. She said, that's clinical research. I said, yeah, but that's what the government's trying to do. That's what CMS is trying to do in this area. And it was the first time in a while that it kind of struck a responding chord with her in terms of talking about that.
So a bunch of things that you said really strike a chord with me, Ted, and I'm, I think I'm going to take them in this order. First, in terms of where the government is coming down and whether this is an overreach, which I've heard from a number of folks, not just you. We had Chip Kahn on our podcast a few weeks ago, and he said this is the wrong idea at the wrong time, essentially. There also are a number of very prominent folks who are standing up and saying, this is a good idea. Don Berwick, former head of CMS, has come out and said, this is appropriate and a test that is fine to do with respect to patient care. How do you explain that? That a number of independent experts, former top CMS official, are saying this is not going to challenge patient care.
Yeah, and I think I have a big disagreement with that, because one of the underlying reasons for doing this are drug prices. And let's, right away, I say this publicly when I speak all the time, I say privately to drug companies, there is a problem with drug prices, especially in the specialty area with cancer drugs, and you need to get a handle on it. The problem is, this won't do it. It will make it worse. And you say, well, how do you say that, Ted? there's been a 10-year experiment going on here, Dan. So back in 2004, reimbursement was changed. So really 2005, they went to the current Medicare reimbursement system.
And with the average sales price.
Average sales price from AWP, the average wholesale price, the average sales price, and plus 6%. And then when the sequester hit in the 2012-2013 area, it actually went into effect. They decreased reimbursement effectively again. So over this period, we've had this naturally occurring experiment. Now, if you look at what's happened then in the cancer space with Medicare, 84% of the chemotherapy was given in physician offices in 2004, the remainder in outpatient hospital setting. And by the way, I'm actually quoting real data out of a study recently released by Milliman, the actuary firm.
I've seen it, but it's apparently seared into your head because you've had to talk about Part B for so long.
Well, I will admit now on a podcast that my wife caught me talking about Part B in my sleep the other day. That's how bad it is. But in 2014...
Bad for your family, good for people who are listening to the podcast, because you're that expert on it, you're thinking about it 24 hours a day, even when you're not thinking about it.
Pretty sad. It's like, Ted, get a life. But in 2014, it had lowered to 54% in the physician setting, the rest in the hospital setting. Now, Milliman calculated that in 2014 alone, that shift of care cost the government $2 billion in 1 year alone, 2014. Hmm. Now, of course, if we look over the period 2004 to 2014, we've seen an increase in drug prices. In fact, in some cases, over a doubling of drug prices on the cancer side. So if you sit back, and by the way, we said this to CMS and CMMI. So we sat with Patrick Conway, Sean Kavanaugh, Tim Groninger, and basically said, I had oncologists with me, practice administrators, and we said, now here's this test. Literally, reimbursement has been decreased twice. It's cost Medicare more, and as a result, it cost beneficiaries more, and drug prices have gone up. So by literally doing this experiment now and severely decreasing reimbursement any further, what can you expect? The only natural thing that you can expect is that it's going to cost Medicare more because there'll be an additional shift of care and drug prices will continue to go up. You can't reasonably and factually expect it would go the reverse way.
Well, I feel like, Ted, I just read an analysis from Alterum on cancer drug spending. Maybe you saw it too.
Yes.
We just linked it in Pulse, where for all the problems with rising drug prices, kudos to the cancer sector, cancer drug price spending has essentially flattened in recent years. And I'm wondering how much of that is because of these experiments that have already been going on. And I think the takeaway from the Alterum analyst was Medicare is playing a positive role in pushing down drug price spending in the sector.
Well, I think Medicare is, because if you look at and take the Milliman study, you basically see a big difference between private pay spending on cancer care and Medicare spending as a result.
Right.
So I think you definitely have that natural event taking place. But the my point is that we'd see even a less or even more of a decrease in spending on cancer care if some of this site of care shift had not occurred, Dan. That's part of the issue that we see here. And you know, it's very interesting. The other thing is, several years ago, United Healthcare, Dr. Lee Newcomer, who's an oncologist with United Healthcare, literally said, "I want to take any incentive away from the drug side." So instead of reimbursing at ASP plus 6 or ASP plus anything, he reimbursed at ASP, so literally at the drug cost, taking any incentive away, and paid sort of a management fee over here, a care management fee. And the write-up of that study in a peer-reviewed medical journal was, paradoxically, drug spending actually went up. And no one, you know, the study didn't attempt to explain.
I've seen that study.
But literally, that's another study. And the point here, Dan, is that, you know, for 3 years, we have been working, when I say we, providers in the oncology space, payers, patients.
You've been working with CMS and CMMI.
For 3 years.
Yeah.
It's been an amazing, transparent, cooperative process that should be the way CMMI should be run. The Brookings Institution was involved. The MITRE Corporation was involved. So you had all this stakeholder input in terms of developing an oncology care model. The practices have been named, ready to get launched. And in the middle of it, you get airdropped literally this experiment that has had no stakeholder input, no expert input, no stakeholder input. And as we said to CMMI, you know, we were starting to feel good about this process. And in 30 seconds, you start feeling really bad and skeptical again.
Well, I've been getting the comment letters for about 2 months now, and I can tell how bad and skeptical the industry feels. Nothing has been more critical than the reaction in my time at Politico this year than around this Part B fight. I mean, it is, I think it's hard for folks who are listening to this podcast who don't live in our world, Ted. Maybe your wife up in Connecticut doesn't see just how bitter things have become here. One comment that I want to read to you, something that I got from a COA letter, I think. Quote, COA is committed to stopping this hastily developed and ill-conceived CMS initiative, even if that requires legal action. Are you threatening a lawsuit here?
Well, here's the problem if you look at this. And I hate to get too wonky about this. I'll wonk out. But basically, here's the problem. If CMS can use CMMI, and by the way, you're talking about one of the biggest fans of CMMI. If you look at what oncologists, and specifically oncologists that have been, I'm talking about our officers, board of COA, have been involved in more payment reform with more private industry than you can imagine. In addition to, there's been actually a Come Home project that's a CMMI grant that was $19 million CMMI grant given to Dr. Barbara McEnany in New Mexico. That project actually showed that you can decrease spending and increase the quality of care. So it's really an interesting situation when you see all this stuff going on, but yet, you know, you say, how can this happen? How can this get airdropped? So you look at it and you say, CMS is using CMMI to basically, and some people, we believe this, do an end round the law. So the Medicare Modernization Act, which was passed in 2003, specifically defines Medicare Part B reimbursement as average sales price plus 6%.
And I'm worried, Ted, you and I and many folks are going to follow this well. Not everyone might. So again, CMMI is the innovation center created under the Affordable Care Act with the goal of potentially scaling up very rapidly demos and tests that work well and putting them into place around the country through traditional Medicare.
Exactly. And thanks, Dan. I've been on a hill talking this all day, so I just literally go right to this is the kind of stuff that my wife says, this is mumbo jumbo. What do you mean? And I have to go back and say, yes, CMMI is the innovation arm of CMS. CMS administers Medicare and Medicaid, but literally in the Affordable Care Act, and now I get really wonky, Section 1115A, created CMMI. And I'm a believer in CMMI because I think one of the ways one of the only ways we're going to get a handle on healthcare costs are doing these experiments. I'd rather be doing more than less. And, you know, but the problem here is when you use CMMI, this arm created in the Affordable Care Act, to literally do a national mandatory demonstration, not a model and a pilot, but you make it mandatory and national, and you're changing the reimbursement rate that was fixed in law. The problem is, if you think about it, it gives you pause because you look back and say, if CMS can do that with CMMI, then they can literally change any Medicare law by doing a national mandatory demo. Because at the end of the demonstration period, what they're testing, in essence, becomes law. So one of the problems we have is that this could be abused. And think about this. Let's say that Mr. Trump is the president next year. And let's say that all of a sudden the administration changes internally and they use the power of CMMI in that statute, in that portion of the ACA, 1115A, to start undoing parts of the ACA, or as they refer to it, as Obamacare. So it wasn't meant for that reason. And I'll go one step further. Look, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. But the fact of the matter is, either CMS is overreaching in using CMMI to effectively overchange law, or the law itself, or that section of the law, was too liberal, and Congress, because Congress can't hand its powers over. The legislative branch cannot hand its powers over to the executive branch. And they're doing that, in which case, that says something about that section of the law. And I am so committed, we are so committed to the premise of CMMI, working with CMMI, because we're working with all these private payers, and it's gratifying to finally see it on the Medicare side. But not when you overreach on something like this.
So I know you said you're not a lawyer, though you work with lawyers. I will ask this question again. Are you threatening legal action if this demo moves forward?
If this demo isn't changed, look, I can't. At the end of the day, that decision is with the board of directors of COA. And I mean that in complete candor. But I will tell you right now, I will go out on a limb on your podcast to say that what we put in that comment letter was voted on by the entire board, and I would dare say that if this is not changed appreciably, the only recourse will basically to be to pursue legal action on this as well, too. There's too much riding. It's not just a reimbursement cut. Yes. Is this a reimbursement cut? Does it affect practice income? Absolutely, positively. No one's going to deny that. But I think the two biggest things, the problems that I have here, Dan, is that number one is an experiment of having the government attempt to get in between the patient and the physician, and number two is the precedent this would set if CMS was allowed to use CMMI to basically and effectively overturn or end run any existing law.
Two-part question for you. Where are we in America on access to oncologists?
Yeah, I think there's a, first of all, you have to understand, here are the overall trends. We are doing a better job treating cancer. More people are living with cancer, but we're diagnosing more cases of cancer. So as a result, the demand for oncologists, the demand for oncology care is actually outstripping the supply of oncologists. If you look at the oncologist pool, you have roughly half of the oncologist pool, I think, are now over the age of 55 or more. We can't mint, if you will, enough oncologists. And even though we have other providers, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, of course, oncology nurses, I give a shout out for oncology nurses because I love them, literally.
And one might be listening to this podcast.
And one might be listening to this podcast, although by now she's going to be rolling her eyes when she listens to it. But I think you can only do so much. You need oncologists. So the first thing you have to understand is basically the demand is outstripping the supply.
So yeah, if I'm paraphrasing there, access is an issue.
Access is an issue. And will continue to be more of an issue, especially with things like this.
Which is a reason I'm curious. I remember 3 or 4 years ago when the sequester hit, there was a lot of talk that the sequester would potentially put cancer clinics out of business, that oncologists had to turn patients away. I'm not sure any group was more vocal during the sequester than oncologists. And my understanding is some of those dire predictions did not come to pass. It makes me wonder, Ted, about this demo where not so long ago, oncologists who make fairly good money, over $300,000, were so worried about the sequester, and it didn't seem to harm them on the level that worst case scenario predicted. Could we be in a similar place now with this demo project? Lots of noise, lots of concern, but in the end of the day, maybe it's not going to be as bad as the worst case scenarios we're hearing predicted.
Yeah, I think, first of all, I don't agree with the sequester had an impact. Sequester actually did have an impact. If you look at, there are some practices that basically sent their patients over to the hospital. And if you look at the trends, we have seen the closures and the absorption into the hospital setting like never before. One of the other interesting things we've seen, at least what the sequester did, which was kind of a positive in a way, is you see more consolidation of practices. So we see a lot of consolidation. If you look at New Jersey now, you have essentially one RCCA, you have one big practice in New Jersey. So a lot of the single physicians couldn't survive Dan. If you look at Florida Cancer Specialists, which is along the west coast of Florida, they're up to 200 physicians now. Same with Texas Oncology. So what we actually saw, the first thing is we saw more consolidation, at least into the keeping it out of the hospital, but we did see a lot of consolidation into the hospital. And if you look at some of the data, that absolutely did occur, and you look at some of the data now, you will see it. So I think the first thing is we saw it. The other thing you have to realize is this is a more severe cut than ever the sequester was. So literally, just so all listeners understand, we were sort of at ASP, this ASP plus six. And there are problems, it's not really ASP plus six, but we won't go into that. We'll say ASP plus six. It went down to ASP 4.3. That was the sequester.
Right,
a lot of people say, I don't understand the math,
like,
but
it's
not on the 20% that the patient pays. It's a part of Medicare. It's the 80% that the government pays, that Medicare pays. You're going down to 4.3 to now 2.5 with this sort of nominal babysitter, $16.80. So if you just think of the math around that, it's a lot more severe. And you hit a tipping point where it's over. Now, I'm not saying that all of a sudden this hits and every practice, it will be gone. I will tell you, though, this will actually be a tipping point. But the other part about this is, as I said before, this isn't just like the sequester. The sequester was a cut, pure and simple. When reimbursement was changed, it was a cut, pure and simple. This is a cut that is dealing with this issue of literally trying to force a change in clinical decision making by using economics. In fact, it's kind of interesting if you think about it, Dan. You have the government saying there's this perverse incentive. And by the way, so your listeners understand, the doctors didn't create this. This was created by the government. It was the Congress and CMS that created this ASP, this average sales price, plus 6%. And now wants to change it by saying, oh, there's a perverse incentive. Doctors shouldn't be following finances. But yet they want them to follow finances to prescribe drugs that are less than $482.
Well, I just have to jump in here because it seems like there are incentives all the time. I mean, we're potentially changing incentives on how physicians prescribe things, but those incentives were originally created by the government. Everything is artificial in a sense,
right?
So it depends how far you want to pull that thread. But there are pilots that Medicare is doing all the time to change incentives, maybe not specifically around medication, but change the incentives of hospitals and doctors with hopes of decreasing cost while keeping quality and care the same or maybe even better.
No, I totally agree with that. In fact, we're big proponents of this shared savings model that basically, first of all, looks at quality and then looks at shared savings in terms of this sort of sharing in terms of reducing costs. So totally agree with that, not objecting at all. What I'm saying is the way the math works out on this, so to get wonky again, there's a cutoff point of $482. So under $482, the drugs will actually increase, their margin will increase above how they're reimbursed now. Over $482, they will actually decrease. Now, what I want to tell you is this. Unfortunately, in oncology, like in rheumatology and other areas, there's not this fact that you prescribe drug A and it's a brand, and there's drug B that's a generic, or even that there's a therapeutic equivalent, so it's a brand drug, but it's less. There are very few situations of that happening. And if you look at those drugs under $482, they are either generic drugs that are actually used now as a part of regimens. So most cancer care is not a single drug. It's a regimen of drugs. So it's a cocktail, if you will, of drugs. And a lot of the drugs under $482 are not even cancer treatment drugs. They're Benadryl, which is given, for example, as, you know, the Benadryl, which is given in a regimen because you have allergic reactions. So you, instead of having allergic reactions, you give it Benadryl. There's some of those sort of supportive care drugs. So it's not this clean, people think it's this sort of clean slate of where you either prescribe drug A is more expensive and drug B or it's less expensive. And that's where you get into the nuances and say, this just doesn't work.
I'm here now with my colleagues, Sarah Carlin Smith, Brett Norman. Hi, guys.
Hey.
How's it going?
So we've heard Peter Bach, we've heard Ted Okun.
I want you to ground me, ground the listeners. You track this incredibly closely. You've tracked this fight for months. How representative are their arguments in the scheme of the fight over the Part B demo?
TED definitely reflects a broadly shared concern that the Innovation Center is going to take over Medicare with these super ambitious experiments. You've heard that from physician groups. You've heard that from patient advocacy groups. And you've certainly heard it from pharma. So that is a kind of cornerstone worry from the people who are complaining about this, is that it's just too big and too broad and has to be scaled back, including from some Democrats in Congress.
I'm not sure I could pick two more charismatic people to make the case either for or against the Part B demo. Given what you two know about the demo, were you swayed either way? Was the argument surprisingly strong by either one of them?
TED makes his case pretty forcefully, but again, it's something we've been hearing steadily, and there's been a growing chorus on that. I think Peter Bach's willingness to experiment in the face of also a very widely shared concern, which is these spiking spending in Part B, shows that there is a willingness out there. There's a recognition by some doctors that these drugs are costing too much, and that we have to we're going to have to try a few different approaches to find out what works.
They're both kind of pulling on your heartstrings a little bit and trying to make the case that patients will be worse off under whichever viewpoint you pick. So TED would have you believe that patients won't get access to the cancer drugs they need under the proposal. And Peter Bach would argue right now many patients in the U.S. aren't getting access to the drugs they need because of affordability issues, and patients aren't well served by the current mechanism of drug reimbursement.
In terms of balance, we had someone for this demo, someone against this demo, but on a daily basis, just given the comment letters I'm getting that people want to see in the Pulse newsletter, the stuff that you two send me, it just feels like the volume against the demo is so much louder than the volume for it. You two have a better read than me. Is that accurate? And how much of that really reflects the industry versus just where lobbyists are spending their dollars?
I think the volume is a bit more against it, but within the camps of people who are against it, there are, and you see that in the political sphere, there are the people that don't love this proposal, but are okay with testing a new method, and would even be okay with that kind of scaled back idea of maybe we exclude rural doctors, or maybe we exclude cancer drugs. And then there are people that just do not want this to happen at all. And so there's a pretty big range, I think, within the no camp.
I feel like there's an increasing, there's an acknowledgement, at least by some in pharma and some of the lobbyists that I talked to, that CMS is likely to proceed with one version of this or another, and that they would like to be in a position where they can kind of work with them and negotiate it into some form that they feel like they can live with better. So I feel like there is some movement from just, the cheerleaders, between the cheerleaders all, go ahead full steam, and the hell no camp, recognizing that this appears to be one of the things on CMS's bucket list in its last year under Obama to get done.
Andy Slavitt said as much. They really want to tackle drug costs because he doesn't want that to be issue number one for his successor. The quote he had was something like, if I don't take care of this, the next guy will say, what was Slavitt thinking? So do we think this demo is going to move forward? I mean, you heard Ted Okun, he's going to sue if it goes into place without necessary changes.
It is very hard with the limited amount of time they have, and just knowing how long it usually takes the government to review comments on a final or a proposed rule and get out the final rule, and then go through all the steps necessary to set up the system so it can actually work in the real world. But CMS does seem pretty intent on at least getting this off the ground just enough so that, say, we have Hillary Clinton or a Democrat in office who would likely want to...
Hillary Clinton or Democrat to be named, yeah.
Yeah, well, she would want to continue that path forward. So they're certainly not going to make any dramatic changes to the drag reimbursement system, I think, no matter what they get off the ground. But it's a matter of if they at least keep the momentum going so that another administration might kind of take that ball and keep rolling with it, or, again, whether they do just kind of cave to all this demand and give up and let someone else handle it.
It seems like it's not likely to happen as fast as they initially proposed, which I think was to get a final rollout early this summer. But I do think in some form or another, probably responsive to some of the Democrats' concerns about the scale of the demonstration, that they'll get something out in the fall and before they're gone.
And then you have to see, because Peter Bach said pretty clearly, if they do kind of scale it back too much, in his opinion, it's kind of worthless at that point.
Right.
And we won't be able to test what we want to test. We won't get the kind of changes to care and delivery we want. So there's that other side of it as to how much they do scale it back so they can do something. Does that affect the ultimate outcome or change?
Last question. I know you're not supposed to say as a journalist what candidate you're voting for, but we're just talking about a demo. So if you had to vote, would you be for this demo, knowing all that you do as expert journalists on this topic? Would you be for the demo, or do you think there is a good argument to not move forward with it?
I think that's a tough question for us to answer in our position, but it does seem like there's like a fundamental thing that most people, regardless of how they feel about this demo, kind of agree that there's a basic fundamental problem with the idea of that add-on percentage fee and providing doctors with more money based on how much the drug costs. And so I think most people agree there's probably a better way to reimburse doctors who buy high-cost drugs and then directly administer to them to patients in the current method.
CMS is going to experiment with these things, like we know it. But there are like legitimate concerns with how big the innovation center can go without just completely doing an end run around Congress. So I feel like people recognize that incentivizing doctors to prescribe more expensive drugs, regardless of whether they work better or not, is generally not a very sound way to go. And this is one crack at that. But I think they're going to need to kind of test it out on probably smaller scale than what they've initially proposed to get a better grip on what might actually work and not limit patient access before they go big.
That's it for Pulse Check today. Thanks to our producers, Matt Sobosinski and Bridget Mulcahy, and our editorial assistant, Mary Lee. You can find Pulse Check on iTunes, Stitcher, your favorite podcast app. It should be there. And please subscribe, leave reviews. Every time we get a new rating, that helps move us up the charts, helps new people find the show. You can always submit suggestions to me, ddiamond@politico.com, and we'll be back again with a new episode of Pulse Check next week.